The following is a meeting with devotees with His Holiness Srila Satsvarupa Das Goswami, given on February 27, 1999, in Baltimore, Maryland.
I got quite a few questions and a gamut of different topics. Thank you. I'll start out with some ones that are personal to me. Someone asked if I could talk about the two new books that have just been published. These books were Every Day Just Right, Volumes 1 to 3, and Passing Places, Eternal Truths. They were just printed in India, but they don't look like they were printed in India. That's because they were printed at a very first-class printer, and this was arranged by Pranada, who contacted these printers through her business of printing broker. And so they're really beautiful books, just physically, and at a price that we were able to afford and pass on to the buyers. In a sense, it's unfortunate that they came out together. The travel book was supposed to have come out a few months ago, and now it must be kind of a burden to the devotees who faithfully buy these books to have two big books and not know which one to start on. Maybe you feel like a college freshman at the beginning of a semester. So I'm sorry about that, but at least they came out. And I'd like to talk first about Every Day Just Right, a very special publication and part of a, I hope, long series. In fact, if we want to continue the business at this printer, he wasn't so enthusiastic to do more of these books because we only print 1,000, and a very demanding book to produce. It has every 16 pages. It has a signature of four full-color pages. But when we encouraged him that we might print 2,000 of each copy and print as many as three of these a year, then he may be more interested. So we had 20 copies here. They're all sold, and you can get them through Gita Nagari Press. And in the author's note, I describe how I came to write this book. And what I just want to say briefly about it, describing this book from my point of view, what it means to me, and then what it may mean to you. So as a writer, what I discovered was that I have a subject matter, I have a way of writing that is my way, that is natural to me, and somewhere along the line I found that. And then, however, that voice, it takes the forms of different genres and different kinds of books, like letters from a sannyasi or fiction and poetry and so on. And so when one book would be finished, I would try to think of what to do next, sometimes be kind of caught in between, waiting for another inspiration. Then it occurred to me that actually everything I write is just one big book with different titles or different conceptions and forms. Why don't I just give in to that or go with that and write actually, literally, a work for as long as I can conceive of writing and put it all into this form, whatever may come. So this is Every Day Just Write. And while it's something very personal to me, very satisfying, my theory is that if somebody is doing something that's very satisfying for them, is natural for them, and honest, and is, from his point of view, the best that he can do, then that will naturally result in what Jack Kerouac calls a telepathic shock to the reader, that he'll see, hey, this person is into what he's doing. And that'll be the best way to communicate rather than putting all your energy into try to cleverly catch your audience and, quote, communicate, unquote, to them in a way that has some kind of unnecessary craft or artificiality. So that's my hope. And of course, I'm really fortunate to have readers who want to read what I write. And so they'll be interested. I had a couple of tips, though, for how to approach this, even for somebody who's initially interested. It's pretty big, and the apparent lack of form may throw you off. So I wanted to point out the main structure of the book is like a diary, although it's something much more than a diary, but it has the structure of being divided into days. So as you read, you can keep that in mind. I myself, making tapes of this, and I stop once in a while and I speak extemporaneously as I read the book. And as I read, I look to get through a day, and then there's a sense of completion. It's like a chapter. They're not very long either. And so this is a basic division of rests as you read. You're reading a big book, and it's divided into days, and one at a time you can share them. But even that's a big bite, a whole day. So within the day, there are divisions by time, and on the page there are divisions that are indicated by skipping lines. So this is, I feel this is quite reader friendly, that you can read. In fact, it's all made up of small sections. I'm a writer of pieces. I write a piece of not too long and then I stop. And then I write another piece of not too long and then I stop. So you can read like that too. You can stop anywhere. Of course, if you want, nobody can stop you. You can do like Madhu Mangal does. He always reads a book from the back first. And he jumps somewhere in the middle. Maybe again towards three quarters, towards the end, and then back and forth. After a while, you'll finish reading the whole book. So this book will work all right like that too. And I can't stop you from first of all going through the book and like licking off all the icing, looking at all the pictures first. But the pictures are meant to go also with the sections they're in. I've already written quite a bit more of these, and they're gradually going to come out. This is a good chance for me to ask if anybody would like to be a proofreader or a copy editor. You would help us get these books out, because there's a big bottleneck right now in that department of the production. Oh, good. So I'll get on to the other questions, but it's for all the workers at Gita Nagari Press. It was a great sense of satisfaction we had that such a beautiful book came out in the first of a series. We feel it'll be very auspicious to keep coming out with them, and I hope that you'll get gradually entangled in them. And as I answer some of the questions, especially about guru-disciple relationships, I'll be referring to books and as important part of our relationship. So I don't want to minimize this other book. It's also a book that I feel is very readable and about Krishna conscious travel writings over a period of almost 10 years. And there's a lot of different varieties. In the middle section, we went through those 17 pamphlets, volumes of Lessons on the Road, got the very, very best. I thought that just stood like little vignettes on their own, and particularly with the travel spirit to them, road descriptions or insights while traveling and everything. And I think they read very freshly, all put together into a new kind of book. That section is called Passing Places, Eternal Truths. That's the middle of the book, and then it has anchors on both sides of some of you who know my books know what is meant by timed books. I've written a timed book, one in the beginning called The Summer Marathon, which was written while traveling, but with certain themes and by free writing. And that was traveling in Europe a few years ago. And then towards the end, the very end, is a fiction of travel, thin fiction of a visit to Spain. And another timed book called My Purpose While Traveling. So it's not just like little scraps here and there. Substantial books of themselves are put together in here, and all with the travel theme. So that's a little review of those books. Also, Madhava Das is already sold all these books, but he's selling some books among friends you have, and tapes from the Tape Ministry. They're available. So the same person who wanted me to talk about the books has another question. The subject of having an active relationship with you. As I wrote in my homage, I wrote to you where I said, it is up to us to make the relationship alive. You have given us so much in the books and tapes and letters. We are the ones to take it up. So I thought this would be this question would be a good place for me to, we're talking about a relationship with me, to tell you a little bit who I am. I'm different than when I than who I was. We all keep changing, and so that's another reason why it's important to have correspondence. If years and years go by, then you don't know the person so well. You're frozen in the relationship the way it used to be. Yes. When the person goes through changes, you like to go through them together. So I used to be much more the traveling preacher, and I used to be a manager, a GBC man. Now I'm mostly staying alone, and my service is reading, writing, painting, and coping with my health limit. And in that context, I'm practicing Krishna consciousness. And that includes very much my relationship with you. Yesterday I had an interview with Nisringananda Prabhu. We did a video on the Guru Tattva subjects. And at the end he asked me some question like, is it tough being a spiritual master? And I said yes. One difficulty is you may try to enjoy the facilities, you may become puffed up. And I said it's also difficult because it can steal your soul, being an actual person. If you think of yourself as a guru, nobody should think of himself like that. But then I said that, but I'm very grateful, and I feel it's a service to Prabhupada, because it forces me to preach. I might have a tendency to not do this, but to be compassionate and responsible for other people with whom I have this relationship. Some of you can sometimes see that it's a burden for me, and you commiserate with me that, is there anything you can do not to have the burden? There are certain things that can make the burden better, but the burden is a burden of love. You wouldn't consider that the mother should relieve her burden of love for her children by breaking the connection. Maybe way she can cope with the children better or be helped with the children, but that's her responsibility. So, I'm grateful that I have this preaching, a compassionate service of trying to help other sincere devotees in this relationship. So his question is that you have to take it up. Yeah, so I'm not coming to you as much as I used to. And it keeps reducing the times that we spend together. And but if that's who I am, and that is who I am, then we both have to accept that, but not necessarily with a diminishing of our relationship. You have to accept me as I am, and I am providing association and a chance to serve and training. Those who hear the first day, I spoke a lot about guru, that the guru is a shiksha guru, even if he's a diksha guru. And I was saying that, so shiksha is coming. And sometimes devotees have pointed out that I don't give such direct instruction what to do. But I actually bombard you with instruction if you, so that you'll learn how to think yourself in your own situation, how to be a genuine person. And I've given so many instructions in that way by telling my own experience. And I know some of the devotees do read the books like that so that they feel that they're with me in a more intimate, enjoyable, meaningful way, and certainly more constant way, by getting these instructions through the books than in these rare meetings. These rare meetings are necessary and important, and so that it doesn't become too abstract. Yes, it is up to you to develop this. Now, another person has a question which is like an extension of this. He says, I read Srila Prabhupada's books and I feel I get direct instruction from them, but I feel the need of a person to represent them to me. I only see you once a year, so how can I reciprocate with you? There's a couple of things in here. There's a reference to Prabhupada's books. So, especially if anybody is here, not my disciple, they may be thinking, why is he talking about his books? Krishna consciousness means to read Prabhupada's books. But as I said in that class about Shiksha Guru, the first thing in my mind is read Prabhupada's books. And if you read my books, very often it's like takes the form of reading notes. I'm reading the Srimad Bhagavatam. I quote the Srimad Bhagavatam. I quote Prabhupada. And I say something that you won't find in Prabhupada's books. I say something like, this is hard to get into. I'm not able to believe this, or something like that. And then I deal with that doubt, or talk about the experience of reading Prabhupada's books. But I give you Prabhupada's books and the inspiration to read them, and some instruction how to tackle it, because a lot of devotees, they don't read Prabhupada's books. They don't read it nicely enough. That instruction is not just to read Prabhupada's books within mind, but to go to the Srimad Bhagavatam, go to Bhagavad Gita, and read it. One devotee wrote me, he read that C.C. Ashraya, and he said, this was very nice, helpful to me. He said, now I'm reading Bhagavad Gita in the mood that you described in C.C. Ashraya, trying to think how Krishna is speaking to me. So he's going to Prabhupada's books. So we have a lot of reading to do, if you want to read Prabhupada's books and my books. So that's one point. But his other point is, this questioner says, he's reading Prabhupada's books, and he's got a direct connection there, but he wants a personal teacher. And he's feeling that I cannot fulfill this if I only see you once a year. So that's already answered, that you don't only see me once a year. You can see me every day. Every day, just write. Every day, just read. And throughout the day at different times. I remember doing this question and answer format. One way we were doing it, I would finish a question and answer, and I would ask, before going on to the next one, I would ask if there was any other further questions. That can be entangling, and people then go off on a tangent, and but I would like to feel that there is some sense of completion. Maybe I'll just try it out and see if it gets. But don't just throw up your hand because you feel you have something to say, and it's not maybe not so much connected to this, but this is the thing you want to say. But only if you feel that this particular presentation I made has raised something central that you'd like addressed. And so I spoke about my books, and I answered this question, which was really, it was like a comment about, isn't it, we could put it in the question, isn't it true that we should develop an active relationship with you, our spiritual master, through your books, tapes, and letters? And it's our responsibility, the disciple's responsibility, to do that. Which is like quite the opposite of the second question, which is almost like a complaint. How can I reciprocate you, because I only get to see you a year? I think it's answered. So, the next one is like the same, and then subject switches. What kind of service, attitude, behavior do you want from your disciples? What do you find offensive? I wouldn't like to use the word offensive in discussing it, maybe because that's so absolute, putting you wrong and me right, like you've offended God, although that is the language we use. I can also offend you. So putting it in relative language, I say, what do I like? What do I don't like in the attitude of a disciple? I don't like if a disciple becomes angry with me for something I do. Somebody was angry that I didn't give enough notice in coming here, or that I'm not staying long enough. But I have my reasons for doing these things, reasons that I decided on, or situations that are imposed upon me, and I'm acting sometimes on motives and in situations that you may not be aware of. And you don't have to always know, but if there is a relationship of disciple and spiritual master, you shouldn't be angry. There should be a questioning and doubt. One should be able to do that, but not when you repeatedly get answers, say of a philosophical nature, that you would continue to disagree with them, and become argumentative. That's, to me, that's very unlikable, and it's very disturbing. I just like some devotees who are sincere and who are trying their best. The service isn't limited to just one kind of thing. Whatever you're doing, you can do it for Krishna and for Prabhupada, and I can be part of your life and try to help you. I want to see disciples be serious about spiritual life. I get very enlivened if they really show signs of advancing, and I can hear about it. We all like affection, any kind of the spiritual affection is not material affection, but when we can be loving toward each other. I like that phrase that Prabhupada was quoting before he came to America. He wrote a letter to Nehru, and he was quoting a speech that Nehru made. And Nehru used the phrase, "Let us be true to one another." That phrase sticks in my mind, that be like that to each other. Let us be true to each other, and all that that implies. We made certain promises, and we should try to live up to them in spirit, even if we can't always live up to the letter of it. I know numbers of my disciples aren't chanting 16 rounds or aren't following all the rules, but in the best cases of those situations, I know exactly how much they are, how many rounds they are chanting, what their ability to follow is in particular, and they know that I'm not angry with them about it. And we're trying to, and they're trying to improve. That's a very nice openness and trust that can exist. And of course, they don't they want to improve. Let us be true to one another. I can't think of anything else than that. So now, there's a variety of a question about service. I'm torturing myself with the idea that perhaps I'm cheating myself. I've always been a gardener, and now that I have land, I love to grow flowers to offer to the deities. However, I also grow flowers, and I'm amazed by their beauty and the way in which Krishna created them. Could it be that I'm tricking my mind to think that because I love to grow and watch all kinds of flowers, in order to bring in Krishna into the picture, do I have to see them as Krishna's creation, or would it be just in Maya? By the way, before I forget, some questions I'm not going to read. This was maybe a close one, but because they are very private about something that would apply just to you, and if I try to answer it, I might be answering it too generally to touch on what your individual spirit, or other people here might not understand. They might laugh at something that's very important to you. So those questions, if you wrote, I'll answer you regularly, otherwise I can't. You can ask me again, put your name on it. I'm able to answer this question because of my experience with a disciple in Ireland who is a very dedicated gardener, and I've shared with her all the different thoughts and hesitations she has. Well, the first thing is, this person says, I've always been a gardener. So this other lady, there's no way around it. She has to garden. She loves to garden, and she kind of must garden. So it's just a question of how to do it in Krishna consciousness. You can say give it up, but some people, they just love to do certain things, and they want to offer it to Krishna. So I encourage her from the beginning, and I see more and more how it is a Krishna conscious meditation. For example, she's able to pray by working in the earth. She's able to reach a state of meditation and relaxation by working in the earth and weeding or planting and doing these things, which is it's a meditation, a centering. And then also she's begun to write about her, the different things she sees, and the nature in the garden is full of all kinds of metaphors, the metaphors of dying and blooming and growing old, and the insects' relationship to the plants. And you just can't imagine it. It's just like so many things are going on in the plant world. It's similar to the human world, but in their own way. And it's when a person with even basic Krishna conscious understanding starts, who at the same time is very fascinated or devoted to plants, in this case, starts talking about it, it just comes out with all kinds of metaphors or symbolic examples of the process of Krishna consciousness, of life and death, his hand and things, and so on. Humility, pride, violence, everything. So the things that she's written are very interesting. She was part of a community that had one newsletter, and all the men would write about different subjects, and sometimes guru debates, and quoting scriptures and everything. But her column was always the most interesting column about the flowers and the different things that you can learn from nature. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says nature is the book by which we can read the spiritual world of God's creation. So those are some ways that a gardening cannot be just sense gratification, even if all the flowers are not cut down and offered to the deities. That's the best and obvious way. You grow a garden, you grow roses and marigolds and give them to the deity. But in some cases, that's not done. And there are different ways that it can also be a Krishna conscious act. So I'm reading this, although there's maybe only one devotee here, or maybe who are like this, very dedicated to gardening. But even for those of us who aren't, you can apply it to your own service. I remember telling this disciple, she was also thinking, maybe this is really Maya, And I said, I quoted to her a quote that I've often given, by William Blake, if the fool would persist in lies. So just keep doing it, and don't stop just because other people are saying that you should stop. And eventually, the truth that you're seeking in that thing, although it seems foolish to others, you'll actually find it. And you'll like follow your star or follow your dream, and don't give up on it. But we shouldn't do this all alone. We should have guidance of a spiritual master. There's much more that could be said, even on that one subject of gardening, but we'll go on. My question is, do you think it's okay, good, to practice seeing Krishna in the little worldly or mundane things in life, even though your seeing Krishna is most obviously tainted and probably quite a bit imaginary? For example, what if you're thinking, it seems like Krishna might want me to buy this guitar? Or Krishna wants me to be particularly kind to this person at this time. So, this is good. He's catching how, in the name of an inviting doctrine to see Krishna everywhere and think that Krishna is guiding you, you could serve yourself up in sense gratification. Make Krishna the water supplier or a mental thing. So this kind of meditation has to be trained by Chakshus Shastra, by seeing through the scriptures. This is the real way to see the world. And that, so you have to know the scriptures. You should be immersed in them. You see this naturally in little children of the devotee family, because they're always hearing Krishna book stories. Then they go out and they say, they'll just talk right away, oh, this is a Krishna, this is a Yamuna River. They talk about Krishna and Krishna pastimes when they see things in the material world, because they're always talking like that. Sometimes the parents and elders are really amazed how Krishna conscious the children are. But it's from that transference of that immersion, what they were doing. If they were watching nonsense TV, then they would do that. As Prabhupada said about Gurukul, he said that whatever the children see, meaning from what their parents are doing, it will make a deep impression on them. But anyway, if you're immersed in a Shastra, then you'll know what Krishna consciousness is. That's regular chanting and hearing. Then, like a scientist, the scientist who is working in a laboratory, he's the one who makes the brilliant discoveries and breakthroughs, sometimes by chance. These odd moments or ordinary occurrences and everything will seem to you more Krishna conscious. And if you think, do I want a guitar? You'll have to think if you can use it in Krishna's service. And you take responsibility. It may be that you want the guitar. It's not that Krishna is telling you, but you say, Krishna, I'm going to use this in your service. Yukta Vairagya. So this is a good footnote to the previous talk that I gave about seeing Krishna within the cloud and seeing Krishna everywhere. It's a good sober note that this has to be done by a person who is trying to attain Chakshus Shastra. Know what that means. You see through the philosophy. If you see somebody dying, you see it in Bhagavad Gita teachings. And you don't have to make an artificial imposition, but you begin to think like that, and then you see the world that way. When you see suffering, when you feel suffering. And I see that all the time in devotees. Devotees, they do naturally reflect that way. Devotees are deep compared to non-devotees. We see the world in that way, to some extent. There's a lot of talk these days about Y2K. But for myself personally, I'm not sure what to think. seems that the more safe and sensible thing would be to be prepared in terms of yet I'm wondering how to be prepared consciousness-wise. I guess the question is how to prepare so that one doesn't lose one's Krishna consciousness. I first became acquainted with this phenomenon by letters from devotees who were either already influenced from hearing from other sources about the inevitability of the terrible crisis starting January 1st, 2000, and also from devotees who weren't so much already on a convicted path, but wanted to know what was it and how should they think about it. So in the beginning, like especially the first letter, I didn't even know what it was. But I tried to give some reply, and just in spiritual terms, just knowing that he was talking about some kind of a crisis and how to prepare spiritually for any crisis and how not to think that we were in a safe environment. But then, as I continued to get letters, then I also got a book, which was a comprehensive book about it, saying the different things that might happen due to this computer breakdown and how to prepare for each of these contingencies. And my main impression while reading was not to stay focused on Y2K, but to think how there are many crises that could take place in this precarious material world, padam padam yat di padam natesham, where at every step there is danger. There could be a war, right, in this country, some kind of unconventional war, especially from terrorism. There can be economic collapse of an order that we have no experience of yet. And just the natural disasters that do occur, sometimes in small version. Not long ago in Ireland, on a very cold day, all the electric power in our house was heated by electric power, went out, and the lights went out. And we suddenly had no way to do anything. So this could take place too. Storms, hurricanes, and things like that. So it's not just one thing. And as a spiritual teacher, I can teach you spiritual preparation. If you want to know about material preparation, you can go to a material expert. It's not my duty to do this, and it would be presumptuous of me to attempt it. It's not the field for a spiritualist, especially to get very, very specific. It's like the Jehovah's Witnesses, at least three times they've predicted the exact date of the end of the world. And to their assessment, it didn't happen. The better they stick to their essential teachings about the end of the world, about the need to be saved, and then they'll always be right. But if you try to play Trikalagya, and you don't really have that vision, look at the crystal ball, nobody can do it. Nobody can say exactly what's going to happen on January 1st, 2000. But we should prepare. And here's an addendum question. Although it's not about U2K, it is on the subject. This is a gradual process, Krishna consciousness, and we think we have time to get purified, not thinking that death is nearer than we know. How can we overcome this mentality and feel more like Prabhupada said about feeling that death is just behind us? But what Prabhupada actually said is death is always in your front. He said that's philosophy. Somebody wants to know what is can you define philosophy? He said, philosophy is when you think that death is always in my front. Oh no, philosophy is to keep death always in your front. In front of you, in other words. So then what do we do? We give up excess material baggage, stop wasting our time, and call out to Krishna to help us. Like in the early verses of the 8th chapter in Bhagavad Gita, it says, whatever you think of at the time of death, you will attain to that. If you think of me, you will come to me. And then again and again in the purports, Prabhupada writes out the full Hare Krishna mantra and says, we should do this not just at the end of life, which will be very difficult to attempt, but always incessantly, constantly chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. And not just mechanically, but prayerfully, and prepare to leave this world one at a time, or however it's arranged. So I'm going to leave you with that on this question. During Thursday's lecture, you were talking about how to be more focused on the chanting. You said we couldn't save the world, nor could we save ISKCON, implying that it is best not to get involved in so many endeavors that distract us from our sadhana. How can we know when it is Krishna's desire for us to get involved as an offering of service to him, rather than a futile waste of our valuable time and energy? First, what did I mean when I said that we shouldn't, that we can't save the world, or ISKCON? I seem to remember that I was commenting on Trinada Peace and Ichenor, on how to chant ideally, and that we should tolerate circumstances and just go on with our chanting. And that was the most powerful thing that we can do. It's the most important thing that we can do. Whereas other things we're not really potent to do much about. However, I didn't mean that we should be completely passive or unengaged. So the question is, to what extent and where should we engage our energies in, let's say, saving the world or trying to help the Krishna consciousness movement, so that it would make a difference in actually making some change, and that we wouldn't just spin our wheels and lose our own spiritual life. There's some trial and error is involved in this. A person finds out. Sometimes you take on something that's too big, and then you learn what you can do. You also have to learn how to say no to all the things that people may want you to do. They want you to save the world and save the whales and save the redwoods and fight the engines and fight the government. So one person's idea of how to save the world is different than somebody else's. So I have to say no to certain causes. They may be good causes too, but I have a different mission in life. So I have to find out what that is. That's a very important point. My personal mission, I'm not referring to mission statements, but use that word. What am I supposed to do on this earth? How am I supposed to serve Prabhupada? How can I give myself the most? What am I meant to do? And that's my contribution. There's too much communication of a distracting level now, especially with electronic communication. The issue-oriented discussion, email, so much of it is prajalpa. So we spend our time much better just turning off and chanting Hare Krishna. That's our first and foremost duty. And how do we do it? We do it very simply, to say starkly. To just nothing else I have to do but hear the holy names. They do the work. I'm so poor spiritually. I have nothing, but I'm going to sit and hear myself chanting the Lord's holy names in this japa meditation. Then, if you do that every day, from that will come a foundation that you'll be in a better position to do something for the world as a Krishna conscious person. If you're not a chanter, you're not immersed in the holy names, then how can you spread the holy names? And if you can't spread the holy names, then what is it you're contributing? Connected to this topic of chanting, my chanting has become stark in inattention, and I am considering starting all over to sweep out bad habits and begin afresh. Any suggestions how I might revitalize my chanting? Well, it's a very individual thing. I really couldn't tell one person unless the person I knew all about the person's life. Things that work for me may not work for you. But there are some basic things. It's good that a person wants to stop bad habits. The worst is that you don't chant, or you don't chant enough. Somehow there's something very important about the 16 rounds. It can sound so external. I remember one disciple of mine in Italy, when he and his wife stopped chanting, and he was really, he had a whole philosophy about why he wasn't going to chant 16 rounds. He said he'd chant when he wants to, and that would be better because the quality would be better. And he said, he was speaking Italian and I couldn't understand him, and it would be translated, but I remember he was saying that, he said, Krishna is not looking at his watch, or Krishna is not counting that is this person chanting 16 rounds, that Krishna is accepting of our love is not such a thing, that he loves somebody who chants 16 rounds, he doesn't love somebody who chants and doesn't count, but chants a little bit. So in that way you can make a mockery of the sudden a principle that Prabhupada has given us in a very stern way, that we make a promise for life to chant 16. But there's something in it that's it's scientific, that you have to get the chanting up to a certain quantity. He used that really nice expression, numerical strength, and a certain vrata, a vow, to do this. It's a commitment, and love is shown in that way. I do this much work. You can't go to work and say, I'm not going to work 8 hours, I'll work as much as I like, and you should pay me as much as anybody else. So numerical strength is a very important way to... Well, how else can we show our sincerity to the spiritual master and to Krishna? Something tangible. And it's an easy thing, but do this much at least. So that's the beginning thing. But then 16 rattled off mechanical rounds and not very pleasing to Krishna. The man was right, saying that Krishna is not pleased to hear a lot of rattling up to 16. But he wants the effort, and he wants the of numerical, and he wants the quality of somebody wanting to be with Krishna and believing that Krishna is in the cloud of the holy name, even when it's offensive, and he's calling to Krishna and calling to his mind to please pay attention. So I would suggest that the person who wants to improve their chanting, and it's very bad, look at their life schedule and put it in order, and put the chanting as in a better priority of a very good time, very best time. That's a sacrifice of time. That holy name, I'm very unable to chant nicely. At least one thing I'm going to start with, I'm going to give you my peak time of day. It's not going to be left to some poor quality where I give the better quality to the non-devotees or to my body or this or that. I'm going to give you the very best time as I calculate it in my 24 hours. And then go on like that, bit by bit, trying to revitalize the chanting. Any question on that? Yeah.
Or some other book, they were talking about priorities, and a man made a demonstration. He put a big jar on the desk, and he was like giving a seminar, and then he started taking and putting big rocks in the jar. and then he put smaller rocks, and then he put gravel, and then he put sand. And when he got towards the end, he said, "Can I put anything else?" And everybody said, "No." And he says, "Oh, yes." And then he put the sand. And then he said, "Can I put anything else?" And they said, "No." And he says, "Oh, yes." And he poured water in it. And so he asked them afterwards, he says, what is the meaning of all this? And somebody said, "You can always fit more in your day." And he says, "No, the meaning is if you put the big rocks in the jar first, you can fit the little things in later." So it's making, if you do the japa first, you can fit everything else. And with the inclinations, I have too much to do, I'll fit the japa in the middle.
Yeah. In class, it seems two kinds of clouds were referred to. Rupa Goswami mentioned the cloud that surrounds Krishna and the cowherd boys and their intimate pastimes. And then there is the cloud we seem to create for ourselves based on our own delusion and artifices and offenses. So how might a devotee balance these two perspectives in approaching Krishna, the covering that protects Krishna's intimate pastimes and our personal covering based on our own envy or lack of strong desire to be intimate with Krishna? So, as you could probably tell from that class this morning, I have a particular angle on this that has really caught my imagination. So this question gives me another chance to explain it. But first, let's look at these two, as he's nicely put it, or she's nicely put it, the descriptions of the two kind of clouds that are mentioned in that verse, Antilila, verse 188, chapter 1. There's the cloud that covers Krishna in his pastimes, as seen by the intimate devotees in Yoga Maya. That is Yoga Maya, that cloud. So they see Krishna as a cowherd boy. Although he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they see him within this cloud of dust from the cow's hooves. Or they see him as the lover, and in the confidential cover of night, they go to him, although he's God. They stay within that covering or protection of his pastimes where the non-devotees cannot enter. So that's the one kind of cloud. And the pure devotees are within that covering of Yoga Maya with Krishna. Now the other, to be covered by personal clouds makes you a cloudy outsider, absorbed in the material modes of sense gratification, and thus unable to see Krishna in this world or in the spiritual world. So now the question is, how do you balance these two? We are already imbalanced in the Maya cloud. My point was, even while in the conditioned state, we can start a favorable relationship with Krishna by faith in his presence. It's like being in prison but realizing your spirit is free. Krishna is here, Krishna is here, Krishna is here. Even where and when I cannot see or hear him. So you can utilize or take advantage of both kinds of clouds. It's not that we have to be completely free of this bad cloud before we can enter into the other. But from this one, we can look at Krishna within the other one with faith. I can't say much more on this, but want you to think about it and practice it. Some things elude too much description. I have been hearing about the concept of Guru Tattva in reference to Guru reform discussion. The person for the position of Guru. The more I think about this, the less I can understand it. Isn't a Guru, in one sense, really nothing more than a disciple who is following his Guru and who continues his master's mission by taking disciples when the master is no longer physically present? Also, what is the meaning of Guru without a disciple? You can't have mother without a child or husband without a wife. Isn't the guru manifested when the relationship manifests, or can you become a guru and then wait for disciples to show up? I realize that this question may be considered volatile if taken in a political context, but I would really like to know how you see it. It seems like it is really simple, but because of politics, it becomes unnecessarily complicated. We could say because of politics and also because of tragedies of and mistakes of persons taking up the relationship of gurus and disciples, and then abandoning that, or demonstrating that they are not fit to do it. But I agree that it is simple, and the philosophy is simple, and the philosophy is clear. I read this mostly, it's not so much a question, but a nice statement of saying that it really appears to be a straightforward and simple thing. Prabhupada said, just like in the university, the critical student, using the word critical in the sense of very, very good, the critical student becomes the next teacher. Always, the master has disciples, and then they become masters. So that's the age-old tradition. And that's what Prabhupada wanted. With Sringananda yesterday, we went over the history of the specific occasion when, aside from it being in Prabhupada's books, we asked him personally, and it was certainly clear to me in a very simple way at that time what he said. But I think because of the mistakes and tragedies, now people think that what Prabhupada said then was being manipulated, or wasn't clear, or that he was actually saying something else. But it's certainly true that what he wanted, as we haven't done nicely, and so we can kind of empathize with why somebody would want to try to imagine he didn't even say that, or concoct that he didn't say that, because it's been turning out so unfavorably. But we can't abandon the traditional path of parampara, that the disciple becomes the spiritual master, and by doing so, he has to just represent the spiritual master very humbly. I spoke quite a bit about this in the first talk, about the role of the founder Acharya and these other things about Guru. In one sense, even what you call politics, it's unfortunate that everyone is really very, very close to the same point of wanting Prabhupada in the center of our ISKCON lives, or the center of our Krishna conscious lives, nobody to usurp his position, everyone to be faithful to him. And so somebody is saying that it should be done by Prabhupada initiating everybody, and ISKCON says no, Prabhupada is represented by his disciples initiating, but they both want the same thing, that Prabhupada's will be carried out. So you can appreciate everyone's sincerity in that regard, not that somebody's all right and somebody's all wrong. Somebody who was not here yesterday wants to know what means the ghost has already entered the mustard. So it was a brilliant example given by Prabhupada that there's a saying in Bengali, the ghost has already entered the mustard, and it refers to and he said, take it as story, if you like, that in India there are a class of persons who chase ghosts from other people, and they do it by a certain chanting of mantra and a little yajna ceremony. And at the heart of the ceremony, the sorcerer, or exorcist, takes some mustard seed, and he throws it at the ghostly haunted person. And when the mustard seed falls on his body, then the ghost is chased away. He said, but in this case, the ghost has already entered into the mustard seed. So then when he throws the ghostly haunted or ghost-infested mustard seed at the man, what will it do? The ghost has already conquered. So this is an example of an endeavor that's doomed to failure from the beginning. And the example he was giving is trying to get happiness in the material body. But the ghost has already entered the mustard. You have a body that's doomed to be unhappy, doomed to die. All these endeavors will be futile because the doom is already there. You're trying to make it better, but it's too late. It's ineffective. So that's what that is. We also, that day, we talked about Hong Kong flu. Here's another question. It seems that Lord Sri Krishna calls people to himself in so many ways in terms of religious or spiritual traditions. Many, many people have deeply satisfying spiritual lives in a variety of spiritual communities. This applies to their progressive intimacy and spiritual growth throughout the lifespan. Faith also seems to transcend tradition. How is it that the Lord calls us to various paths, and how is it that we have been called to Lord Krishna? Our desire was pressing, confused, and desperate. Other traditions have satisfied others, and probably could have satisfied us. How is it we heard this call and have responded? I was looking to in answering this for an excerpt of a speech by Prabhupada, which I put somewhere as a found poem, but just now I couldn't find it. But it goes something like, he's describing how he came in contact with his spiritual master by divine providence. And he said, who knew that I would meet my Guru Maharaj? He was born somewhere in a different family. I was born in a different place. Who knew that we would come together? He said, and you, all of you, said, you were born in such a faraway, foreign place, and you did not know me. Who knew that we would come together in this relationship? It is all the arrangement of Krishna. So that's one answer to the question of why we are Hare Krishnas and not Protestants or Catholics or Jews or Baha'is or something else, or atheists. It's somehow Krishna's arrangement. If you want to try to analyze it, you can. There's a statement about this I gave once before in a class given by the Christian philosopher Kierkegaard. He raises the question, as a Christian, could I have been saved by somebody else other than Jesus Christ? He said, if I try to answer this by giving any reasons, then it immediately makes a mockery of my connection. It certainly doesn't explain it. And he gives the example that a man does not give reasons why he loves his beloved wife. This was an example by a philosopher who is very strong in reason and who is using reason to be, you could say, anti-rational, or to be irrational, or rather to show the limits of reason, that in some realms, reason has no entry. And that's also there in Prabhupada saying, who knew? It is all Krishna's arrangement. Why don't you follow Narayan Maharaj? Why do you follow Srila Prabhupada? You start giving me the reasons on one level. It just doesn't work because your love for Prabhupada is something absolute and not subject to a relative comparison and so on. In my own case, now this is a very like non-mystical personal history explanation, and you can probably give your own on this level too. I was raised in one of these traditions, very old, time-honored tradition with mysticism and teachings from all over the world by great saints and the Roman Catholic tradition. But as I grew up, I never experienced any religion. Religion wasn't talked in my home. My parents weren't religious. I never met a pure devotee within that religion that I was raised in. And then I met a great saint who happened to be in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, Srila Prabhupada. So as this questioner says, we could have been within our own tradition religious, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen to me. I wasn't religious until I met Prabhupada. Then I became mad after God. So, and although I was saying we can't give reasons, in another sense, we can, in personal history, that he saved me, like Narada, like Prahlad says of Narada, my spiritual master saved me from falling into the pit of snakes, like the demons. How could I ever leave him? So, I think in each case, we came to Prabhupada, and we came to Krishna consciousness, and let us hope that it is a very deep and unchangeable thing, and not a fad. From the outside, to Westerners, it looks really strange what we've done. I remember some years ago, Madhumango and I, we visited a Carmelite monastery in Belgium, and there were some young monks there who were very open. But then they introduced us to one of the big shots, one of the elders. And his main thing was he didn't see how Westerners like us, why do we adopt an Eastern process like this and wear these clothes? Which is such an external way of looking at it, but he couldn't get past that. Where the younger ones, they got past it, and they were interested in what Krishna consciousness was, and we were interested in the Carmelite tradition. He was just hung up on this, why is a nice boy like you taking up an Indian process? It is Indian, and you're American. There's something to that, of course. but Prabhupada gave us Krishna consciousness in such a way that although it has what looks like Indian trappings to it, and we have to adjust to that, we do have to live up to the fact that we are Westerners who have taken to Krishna consciousness, but it is transcendental, and we experience it that way. So it may look strange to outsiders, but we feel very comfortable as devotees. I hope we do, and that we should never think of leaving. Now, another part of this question, or it raised a question in my mind, because the questioner is saying that all the paths are, in one sense, valid. But are they all the same? Is anyone the best? Is ours the best? I'm not going to address this whole topic, but sometimes we do see all the paths as equal, at least if they have bhakti to the Supreme Person. Religion without God is not religion. We don't say yatamat tatapata, any path you take, it's all equally good. Krishna consciousness teaches us the science of God, whereby we can understand, we really get a grasp on things, who are karmis, who are jnanis, who are yogis, who are bhaktas, and that applies to all different religions. We can see who is really practicing good. Ahaitukiya pitihata, yayatma supersedati. There are many different ways and symptoms to understand who is more advanced in religion than another. And I agree with the questioner that it's not limited to the Hare Krishna movement, but within any bona fide theism, there are levels of advancement. So I would just like to tell all of you, and you already know, that Krishna consciousness is a very bona fide path, and if you want to fulfill your spiritual life, you can do it in this tradition. You don't have to go out into another tradition. However it is, however you got here. Who knew? Anyone have any question about that or comment? Yeah.
I think for myself, religious police I was brought up in.
Haridas, would you like to say anything? It's his question. It's a good question. Taking, approaching it from the broad-minded viewpoint. In other words, our attachment to our gung-ho attachment to Krishna consciousness should not be arrogant or actually sectarian. It should be appreciative of others, and yet at the same time, we're not going away from the lotus feet of Prabhupada and Krishna for any other path. Mahendran? Sure, but it should be toward God. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's bhakti. Rabindra Swarup Prabhu was invited some years ago at some religious conference, and the topic was people came from different religions. What does your religion contribute to other religions or to something like that? So he chose that Krishna consciousness teaches that bhakti is present in every religion. And so, like anyone can learn from Krishna consciousness what bhakti is and then see how they have it. We stress this so much that religion means bhakti, devotion to God. And anybody in another religion can benefit from this. So, therefore, certainly, we recognize bhakti in devotion to God, wherever it may be practiced. Yes.
Tape that you made some years ago called the Universal Religion, where you were reading a tape by Mahatma Gandhi. He was saying, whatever path you're on, you should think that that's the best path. Otherwise, how can you follow it with enthusiasm? You have to think that's the best. So then somehow or another, we came to what actually was the best path.
Yeah.
But he said that you shouldn't propagate it. Like in an insistent way of putting others down.
Yeah.
So you can respect. You go to some other place of worship and respect. Oh, this is my God.
Right.
In a different way.
Yeah. I remember that essay. He said, the Muslims, they bow down in a certain way. The Christians bow down in a certain way. We bow down in a certain way. Oh, so many questions. Kitanagi?
Still, it's my opinion that when one is ready, actually seriously ready, to free himself from the material world, end the cycle of samsara, that means Krishna consciousness. Like the other religions, not to, put a down or anything like that. But I'm thinking that the only way to get out of this, at least from my understanding of Krishna consciousness, the only way to get out of the material, if you want to get out of the material world, eventually you have to come to Krishna consciousness. So in that way, it's not the best religion, even though it seems prideful to say that.
I agree. I was at one lecture where the speaker was questioned if devotees had feelings, and he seemed to say, we're not the body, we're the soul. I didn't like his blunt reply. How would you answer that question? This sparks off in me the feeling of that speaker who was so blunt and maybe insensitive, and then maybe at the same time giving perfect answers. Strange as that combination is. So, as Gitanagri just said, we have the best and the perfect philosophy, but we have to speak that as human beings according to our realization and with care for the audience and care for others. Not just recite it, possibly even with false ego motives, with anger and so forth. The truth is a very powerful thing, and it has to be spoken by, as far as possible, by truthful people, not used as a weapon. So, these perfect teachings, they have to be spoken at the same time with awareness for time and place and person. I'm not speaking of the way I'm writing in my books. I write a lot like that. Not just write the perfect teachings, but emphasize how it's actually experienced. And what is the reality of trying to practice Krishna consciousness? And if there's an excess of only the spirit or the perfect teachings without awareness of this other dimension of how it's actually lived, then the Krishna conscious preacher may really look strident, may look hypocritical, arrogant, dogmatic, to people who are spiritual seekers. And this very thing that we want them to get, this best religion of all the religions, they don't get because they're really turned off. I heard this Hare Krishna guy, and somebody said, is it all right to have feelings? He said, no, feelings are Maya. We're not this body. And then he just gives these answers without really looking into his own heart. So how would I answer that question? Do devotees have feelings? Yes, we have all kinds of feelings. Feelings of love for our mothers and fathers, and feelings of fear and sex desires, and feelings of happiness in nature. And these different feelings can be dovetailed in the service of Krishna. Of course, this I'm describing the immature devotee. The immature devotee is a natural phenomenon too. Prabhupada talked about him in that letter to Lynn Ludwig, and he said, nevertheless, the devotees are doing a very great thing. They're trying to get away from Maya, and sometimes they're very negative, the way they're kicking Maya off. But at least they're not trying to love Maya. We're talking about the devotee should be more loving. But they're doing a great thing. You're trying to love Maya. And they're trying to get away from Maya, so they're pretty negative. But when they become mature, they'll be able to love everyone. So please forgive them. But we expect, however, that especially a devotee who's taking on a lot of preaching and answering questions, not to be so immature, and to be a little humble, and to think before you just rattle off the perfect teachings. So anyway, I would answer the question that all different kinds of feelings can be used in Krishna's service. You have any? You asked that question.
Right. When the question was answered, I was thinking to myself, like you were saying, that I do have all these feelings, and this person is denying it in the name of our philosophy. I recognize our philosophy, and I want to practice it more. But I felt that he was certainly cut off from me in the way that he answered it. So I was thinking, like you were saying, how can anybody listen to such a person and learn about Krishna?
So the questions aren't always put in any particular order. We're bouncing back now to a personal guru-disciple topic. You must get so many letters, and I don't want to burden you. Do you really want to hear the details of my difficulties? How much time can you afford to answer my letter anyway? Should I just read your books and get instruction? So, I mentioned how there's a burden, and sometimes you might even see me, or actually I express it in my books often. Oh, I got all these letters, I have to answer these letters. And so you're being very sensitive sometimes, and you think, well, if that's what he thinks, then I won't send him any letters. But although I may protest like that, it would be worse if I didn't get letters. When I don't get letters, then I'm not a mind reader, and I just imagine that somehow or other the relationship has waned on the other side, and the person, I'm not so important in that person's life. And of course that has happened a lot. My relationship with numbers of disciples, large numbers, has completely stopped, and I never hear from them for tens of years. So I know it's over. So when you start, when your time of not having spoken to me starts building up, then I start thinking, well, I guess that person's not doesn't want any kind of exchange anymore. So I want letters. No, I don't have to hear the details or all the gory details, but I do like to hear what you're going through. If you're going through a divorce or if you're going through some sickness, don't think, well, I'm so much in process now that I'll wait till I get out the other end of this tunnel, and you never get out of it. It just keeps going on and on, and then you later tell me you're in a completely different place, and you say, well, I didn't want to burden you while I was going through that, but anyway, I knew you didn't have the answers, and you don't like to talk about those things. But it's true. But I could have just said, I could have been with you, been beside you, and said, well, this is a very difficult time, so you'll have to think of Krishna, remember Krishna. And just by hearing somebody you trust say that, then it can help you a lot. I don't have anything to say often that can relieve you of the difficulty. But I'm willing to bear it with you, to hear you, and to try to be your friend and give you Prabhupada's teachings. That's how I can be your friend. Help you to remember Krishna. How much time can you afford to answer my letter? I can afford enough time. Whatever time it takes to read the letter and answer the letter. So at least once, you can write every 2 months, but and no more than say once a month. Some people are better at it than others. It's just one way of expressing Krishna consciousness. I guess for Prabhu doesn't write letters, but I love him. He loves me. We're with each other on the transcendental plane. I just have to hear every so often that he's over there, South Street, and charming the people. And giving out smoke and prasad. So I know some people that, just like I'm a writer, so I can't understand why people don't write. But I'm not a mother. I don't know what it's like to take care of children. The things that are completely beyond my experience. And so I don't know what to say if you can't write, but find some other way of keeping our relationship. Then in that case, you can read the books. And maybe you can see some other devotee and tell them that when you write, tell them about me, tell them I'm over here. I'm doing all right. Yeah.
More of a comment to the devotee when we were talking about discussing our problems with you. And my husband, I hadn't written to you about a problem for a long time, and my husband told me that even if you just write to the spiritual master and tell him that just the writing of it and sort of, surrendering the problem, instead of thinking you're the one controlling it, I mean, I'm adding to him a lot, but, that can help you. And I did it, and it's true. some kind of magical thing going on there that if you just tell the spiritual master, even if he doesn't say specifically you must do this, that it can help you to get through the problem.
And those also that reminded me of the people who usually, it's very difficult for them to write, and they don't write for years. And then I suddenly get a letter, and it starts out something like, I don't know how I'm doing this, but suddenly I'm writing this letter. I never thought I could do it. Well, here goes. And then and they say a little something, and then it's over. Phew, boy, I wrote a letter. So they find if they just drop all their blocks, they're doing it somehow all of a sudden. And it wasn't so hard. Some people say you can't be Krishna conscious and sad at the same time. What do you think of this? You don't think that's a serious question? Because Prabhupada, you may think that it's a silly question, because Prabhupada says unless you're happy, you can't be Krishna conscious. But the fact is, we often are sad, and so does that mean that you can't be Krishna conscious when you're sad? So I think you can be sad in a Krishna conscious way too. I had experience recently where I was painting alone in a room where I paint in Ireland, and I suddenly felt very lonely. And then in that mood, at first I thought, not so much discursively thought, but felt, well, what should I do about this? My life is so lonely. Is there something I should do? Is some people I should go with or reach out to? And then I just stayed with the feeling of lonely because I knew I was rightly situated in what I was doing. I was doing what I wanted to do, but nevertheless, I felt very lonely. And then, by accepting my lot and knowing that this is what I wanted, and so I feel lonely on my path, then suddenly, if I happened to be doing something that I hoped would be creative, it started coming out in a strong creative expression, and I was able to use the loneliness. And then I thought also that it was like a social act too. I thought, oh, this will be helpful for other people if I can express this, because we're all lonely. And now I'm, at least for the time being, I'm experiencing it somewhat intensely, and if I can express it, and then people can see it and share it, it won't just bring them down, but it'll help elevate them by touching them in that place, which eventually and automatically leads to Krishna consciousness, because that's why we're lonely. So sad is a similar thing, where you may be sad because you lost your wife or your toy broke or something, but at the center of it is that I left Krishna in the spiritual world. So you can be sad in Krishna consciousness, even if it starts with something that's not like Radharani being sad. The pure devotee, there's that story of Prabhupada, and his devotee looked at Prabhupada in his passport picture where he looked so grave and the corners of his mouth were turned down. And the devotee said, Prabhupada, you look so unhappy in that picture. He said, oh, that was a moment of ecstasy. So, but what kind of ecstasy was it? We see Prabhupada in smiling ecstasy, so it was a different kind of ecstasy of gravity. Same point. When Vyasadeva was not Krishna conscious when he wrote the Vedas. Was Vyasadeva not Krishna conscious when he wrote the Vedas? That is why he was despondent. So here's another sad. Vyasadeva was sad. In that case, he was not fully Krishna conscious. That's why he was sad. But then he went into introspection. Why should I be unhappy? I've done so many religious things, even Krishna conscious things. I discussed this with Jagasundar, that first of all, it's a pastime of an arrangement of Krishna so that the Srimad Bhagavatam could be written. It doesn't negate all that Vyasadeva wrote, Bhagavad Gita, within the Mahabharata, the Vedas, and Upanishads. But it emphasizes positively the special place of Srimad Bhagavatam above all these other literatures, because it concentrates on pure bhakti, to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the way Arjuna appeared to be in Maya so that Bhagavad Gita could be preached to him and everyone, Vyasadeva appeared to be unhappy to set the stage for his mature work. What are some of your favorite things? Parts of your days, parts of your life. I like to get up at midnight and go into a room where there's a desk and a light. And read Prabhupada's books first thing. I very much like that time of day. From 12 to about 6 o'clock. And